from WBUR Boston and NPR. I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. This week, Trump on the international stage, an explosive immigration cutoff, and a new pick for the Supreme Court. At yesterday's National Prayer Breakfast, President Trump spoke to rough phone calls he's had with foreign leaders, most lately Australia's.
Don't worry about it. Just don't worry about it. They're tough. We have to be tough. It's time we're going to be a little tough, folks.
There were protests all over the country condemning President Trump's executive order blocking refugees from entering the U.S. Here, yesterday, shopkeepers in the streets of New York. And Senator Jeff Merkley, Democrat from Oregon, told MSNBC he will filibuster Judge Neil Gorsuch, President Trump's nominee to the Supreme Court.
This is a seat that was stolen from the former President Obama. That's never been done in U.S. history before. To let this become normal just invites a complete partisan polarization of the court from here to eternity.
This hour On Point, our weekly news roundtable with Susan Page, Byron York, and On Point news analyst Jack Beatty. You can join us on air or online where this conversation is always on. What do you see in week two? Iran on notice, Australia on notice, Judge Gorsuch and the Supreme Court? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Joining me now from Washington is Susan Page, Washington Bureau Chief for USA Today. Susan, great to have you with us. Thanks for joining us today.
It's great to be back with you.
Also with us from Washington, Byron York, Chief Political Correspondent for The Washington Examiner. Byron, welcome back. Great to have you as well.
Hi, Tom. Good to be here.
And from Hanover, New Hampshire, Jack Beatty joins us. Hello, Jack.
Hello, Tom, Susan, and Byron.
We have a lot to get into here. Susan, just take us first to, here we are, week two. It seems like longer, but just the tempo and texture of the Trump administration in week two now of his arrival in office.
Well, Tom, this is the sixth president I've covered, and I've never seen anything like this. There have been presidents who tried to get off to a quick start. That was certainly true of President Reagan. It was true of President Obama. But I don't think we've ever seen anything like the pace of change that we've seen in the past 2 weeks. The number of topics and subjects and issues that the new president has gotten engaged on and the fierceness of his reaction. This is really a new experience, at least in recent times.
Byron, how do you see Republicans on that pace of change? Are they comfortable with the way Trump is setting off here? And what about Democrats in response, Byron?
Well, they're not entirely comfortable because they never know what's coming next like the rest of us. I do think we're in kind of an executive action phase right now where Trump wants to get a lot of stuff on the table via executive action. A lot of Republicans think that Barack Obama made executive action kind of popular, so they want to do that. But what's moving much more slowly is when they move into the legislative phase. The Republicans kind of set a deadline for themselves to repeal and replace Obamacare. That was kind of a joke. It didn't happen. But it appears that they will be moving on some sort of tax reform fairly soon. But right now, the way Trump has created this flurry of activity is entirely with his own executive authority.
I want to ask about things that feel like they could be on a hair trigger. You tell us. But this was Wednesday. In the middle of a briefing, the National Security Advisor Michael Flynn, former General Michael Flynn, stepped to the podium and sounded a warning to Iran after Iran's ballistic missile test on Sunday. Here was Flynn.
President Trump has severely criticized the various agreements reached between Iran and the Obama administration as well as the United Nations as being weak and ineffective. Instead of being thankful to the United States in these agreements, Iran is now feeling emboldened. As of today, we are officially putting Iran on notice.
Susan Page, what does that mean? Donald Trump spoke in very hot terms on the campaign trail about Iran. Now he's got his top security guys saying on notice. What does that mean?
Well, on notice is actually not a diplomatic term of art for which there is a clear definition. But I think we saw something about what he meant just today when we believe that the White House is going to move ahead with imposing some sanctions on Iran. Now, it's interesting. The rhetoric on Iran is definitely tougher than the rhetoric in the Obama administration, and the actions may well be tougher. But one thing that's interesting is that at least in this imposition of sanctions, it does not involve trying to dismantle the nuclear deal with Iran that was the subject of a lot of very tough commentary by Donald Trump when he was running for president. This is a separate issue that involves violation, this administration says, of a UN resolution. And so on this and some other things dealing with foreign policy, the administration, this new administration definitely takes a different tone, but in some ways they are not doing everything that they said they were going to do. We see another example, for instance, just last night on policy or the attitude toward new settlements in Israel, where a White House statement was put out that was very consistent with a statement that you might have seen the Obama White House put out.
And here, some said, surprisingly, Nikki Haley, the UN ambassador, condemning the Russian occupation of Crimea yesterday. All kinds of reports of renewed fighting in neighboring Ukraine, or Ukraine would say in Ukraine, today. Her first speech for an open briefing for the Security Council. Here was Nikki Haley.
The United States continues to condemn and call for an immediate end to the Russian occupation of Crimea. Crimea is a part of Ukraine. Our Crimea-related sanctions will remain in place until Russia returns control over the peninsula to Ukraine.
Jack Beatty, what do you see here? I mean, we had President Trump and Vladimir Putin talking over the weekend, people paying close attention to that. And the next thing we heard, there was renewed fighting in Ukraine. I mean, heavy fighting, lots of shelling and all the rest. Some thought, well, maybe that's a subtle green light from Trump to his admired Putin. On the other hand, here's Nikki Haley saying, sanctions until you're out of Crimea, which Russia shows no signs of doing.
Yes, and I think it's a very heartening signal. Yes, 24 hours after Trump's phone call with Putin, there were reported 2,300 explosions from artillery along that that eastern Ukraine front, and the shelling was with heavy weapons that were banned or that were agreed not to be used under the Minsk agreement. And it's gone on since then. There were 10,000 shellings in all from both sides. And I think we're about 30 people killed. Violence now, people say, is at its worst since these hostilities broke out in 2014. So it was heartening, I think, to hear that, to hear the condemnation of this action from the UN ambassador, and especially to hear the, you know, there was some talk about, in fact, Kellyanne Conway gave it credence that maybe they were thinking of relaxing sanctions on Crimea, no, according to the UN ambassador. So I think this was a, from the point of view of a consistent U.S. foreign policy, which has some values in it, this is a heartening moment.
Byron, what do you make of the tough talk with Russia and on Israeli settlements after the sounds that seemed somewhat different before?
Well, on Russia, I'm not surprised at all. And I think people, if they're really, really surprised about this, then maybe they weren't listening very closely. There was all this talk beforehand about some sort of bromance between Donald Trump and Vladimir Putin. But Trump's public statements, he always said something like, of course we want better relations with Russia, of course we do, but it's going to depend on what they do. We'll have to see. Maybe they can offer something. Maybe there's some sort of arrangement, a deal that can be made. He was always suggesting that Russia would have to change its behavior if they were going to get some sort of lessening of sanctions. And clearly, with what's going on Ukraine, Crimea, they're not changing their behavior, and I think Nikki Haley basically said that. So I'm not really terribly surprised on that.
You think it's the same old reset, Byron, as we've seen at the beginning of almost every administration for a while, that effort to get back on a better path with Russia?
Well, they don't have one of those big plastic buttons.
That's the only difference?
No, I don't think it's the only difference, but we'll have to see. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's just way too early, but I think it's clear that the president always said that if you're going to have a closer relationship with Russia, if you're going to ease some sanctions, they're going to have to give up something for that. There's going to have to be an arrangement, and so far there hasn't been.
But Byron, if I could just maybe disagree a little, I think one reason that there's been an expectation that there may be some more significant change in policy toward Russia is not only what he said about sanctions, but also the fact that as president-elect, he continued to dispute the conclusion of U.S. intelligence agencies that Russia had deliberately meddled in our election with the idea of helping him win election. And he's also repeatedly praised Putin as a strong leader, sometimes comparing him favorably to Barack Obama. That is, Barack Obama is not nearly as strong a leader as Vladimir Putin. That is clearly a different tone than we've heard from any American president.
I mean, whatever the reason, the fighting is back on in Ukraine. And, of course, this is widely seen as, I mean, Russia's definitely involved there. Here's an unnamed woman in Ukraine telling BBC this week, fighting is really heated up.
It's like a concert every night. We can't sleep. We go to work, ride the bus, and there is a shooting all around.
Byron, what do you make of the change of tone on Israel here, or the comments on a new Israeli settlement, and Trump saying,
yeah.
Well, no.
Yeah. Well, there's no doubt that the administration has been extremely pro-Israel rhetorically coming in. And in some of their personnel choices, getting people who are very, very, very strong supporters of Israel.
U.S. And, ambassador, not least.
The president really criticizing Barack Obama as one of his final diplomatic decisions to have the U.S. abstain with that United Nations resolution. So you get the idea that basically the United States is giving Israel the green light to do whatever it wants. I interpret the statements from Sean Spicer, which basically it's the most gentle of statements, saying that, well, you know, doing a few more settlements might not be helpful to Middle East peace. I think that may be a recognition that perhaps they rhetorically overshot the mark and want to make sure what their position is as far as an increase in settlements leading up to Netanyahu's visit with Trump on February 15.
And Susan, a blow-up with the Prime Minister of Australia? Really?
You know, talk about rhetorically overshooting the mark. It's got to be that 25-minute phone conversation with the Prime Minister of one of our closest allies.
Which was supposed to be an hour or something, but no,
cut short. Now, there is a dispute that whether Trump actually hung up on the Prime Minister of Australia, but clearly a conversation that went badly against a nation with whom there's no nation other than Great Britain with whom we are closer and have relied on more as an ally than Australia. And the suggestion there that raised a lot of concern, I think, around the globe is that the United States is not prepared to live up to an agreement that we reached by the previous administration on taking refugees.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're looking at a week in the news, immigration ban and blowback, a Supreme Court pick, Trump battles Australia, new fighting in Ukraine. Susan Page is with us, Washington Bureau Chief for USA Today. Byron York is here, Chief Political Correspondent for the Washington Examiner. Jack Beatty's here, and you can join us. What do you see in week two on immigration, travel, all of that? Wow, what a weekend that was last weekend. How does Justice Gorsuch sound to you? Should Democrats fight to the last or save their powder? And where do you stand on the immigration ban, the 120 days on refugees, the 90 days on the 7 majority Muslim countries? Is it a reasonable pause? Is it a terrible signal? Wow. Jack, can we come to last weekend and the executive orders that came out late Friday that led to just a wild weekend all over this country, airports filling up with protesters, the Trump administration standing strong by this? And you know the bones of it. We just outlined them there. All refugees blocked from the U.S. for 120 days. Refugees from Syria indefinitely. 90 days, no entry from Iran, Iraq, Libya, Somalia, Sudan, Syria, Yemen. And what a blow up it was, Jack. What did you read in all that?
Well, on the merits, it just doesn't make any sense to me. According to the Cato Institute, which is not a Bolshevik organization, it's funded, I think, by the Koch brothers in part, the chances, they have studied this, that over a 40-year period, the chances of an American being killed here by a refugee, the chances are 1 in 3.64 billion per year. And no terrorist has emerged in the United States from these countries on the list, or has committed an act in the United States from these countries. So the premise of it doesn't seem to makes no statistical sense, at least. It's a phantom fear, it seems to me.
And yet it was the list, and those 7 countries, Jack, that was the list that the Obama administration had said, well, these are—
You've got to watch this.
These are terrorist problem countries.
Yes, and a certain strict scrutiny needs to be applied, but there's a difference between applying, you know, substantial scrutiny and this ban, and then on the other side, what are the consequences of it? If security people like Michael Hayden, former CIA director, are right, or former soldiers like Seth Moulton, the congressman, are right, this is going to, one, greatly arm Al-Qaeda and ISIS with propaganda to use against us, And Moulton even suggested it could endanger U.S. servicemen serving alongside Kurds and Iraqis in Iraq. So that has a downside. The upside seems to be, it's hard to see, $1 in $4 billion. But I do think what it does is it puts fear right at the center. I think everything the Trump administration does has to be examined in the light of its potential danger, the danger of this administration. When I see people like Norm Ornstein, the Congress watcher, warning about authoritarian tendencies in this administration, warning that that's the direction that it can go in. When I see David Frum, another conservative, in an eloquent piece in The Atlantic saying, look, it'll begin with small things, but it could grow. I think you need to look at this kind of fear and say, wait a minute, what's the point of making Americans afraid of a phantom threat because they might go along with even more drastic measures against Muslims here? Or it might allow Trump to say, look, I delivered you from this menace and pocket some political advantage. In any case, you just can't look at this as an isolated matter.
I'll put that to Byron and Susan. I mean, by Monday morning, after a weekend of big protests and all kinds of confusion, some chaos along the way there, the White House wasn't having any of it. A lot of pushback had come from the State Department there, a big memo that's making the rounds globally. Nearly 1,000 people inside the Foreign Service have signed it. Here was Sean Spicer on them.
These career bureaucrats have a problem with it. I think that they should either get with the program or they can go.
Get with the program or go. Tuesday, Senator Elizabeth Warren spoke at a congressional Democrats rally against the executive order on immigration, said the ban has to be reversed.
Donald Trump has issued an executive order that is illegal, that is unconstitutional, and that is immoral.
Susan Page, how do you read the executive order, the impact, import of it?
Well, we'll find out if it's illegal and unconstitutional. That's not clear. Presidents have a lot of authority when it comes to regulating who can come into this country. And one thing to remember, President Trump is doing precisely what candidate Trump said he would do if he won the election. So that gives him, I think, some standing to proceed, at least with the people who supported him. I think even the White House would admit that there were problems and disputes and difficulties that they didn't intend, that they didn't think through. Maybe that's a worrisome sign in itself. But for instance, the fact that green card holders were initially covered
those are legal residents of the United States who for a time were stopped at the border.
That's right. Not allowed back into the country where they live. The fact that it included people who had worked, Iraqis who had worked as translators for U.S. soldiers, for U.S. troops, and put their own lives on the line, were blocked and not allowed to come in using visas that had been issued to them. So I think the White House would acknowledge that there were some problems with this, but they would continue to argue that this is a step that he said he was going to take, and actually all the steps that President Trump has been taking, including the most controversial ones, are pretty much things that he's talked about during the campaign. There was no bait and switch when it comes to Donald Trump.
Byron, I want to bring it to you. Let me go to our listeners first, if I may. Craig in Onalaska, Wisconsin. Craig, you're on the air. Thanks for calling.
Hi, Tom. President Trump at one point said that as president, America would be winning again. In fact, we would probably win so much that we would get tired of it. His first 2 weeks in office have been very chaotic, and he just seems to lurch from one problem to the next, and mostly of his own making. I think the courts and Congress need to take a strong stance against his authoritarian-type rulings, and we need to get America back on track where we are more united. He's done nothing but divide this country in the last 2 weeks.
But Craig, what if this is President Trump's idea of getting the country back on track? This is his, clearing the brush for all that winning to begin.
It's not. You cannot divide a country in half and have half as winners and the other half as losers. You need to be able to see both sides of an issue and try to come up with something that generally works. When you have foreign leaders that are talked to like children, you have countries that are and religions that are put down. You have just any number of things, the environment, scientists. You know, he looks at science as basically voodoo, and that's crazy. We need to get back on track.
Craig, we've got it. Byron York, can you thread this needle? The immigration executive order, Trump's promise of winning, the sense Craig feels there of greater division now. Does the new president care about that?
Well, look, I think with the executive order, after fixing a couple of the problems that Susan mentioned, the green card problem and the problem for to make special case allowances for people who have helped us, for example, in Iraq.
Yeah, interpreters and so on.
After taking care of those two things, you know, I think there's absolutely no doubt that the plan is constitutional. Foreign nationals in foreign countries do not have U.S. constitutional rights, and that it's legal. As Susan said, the law does give the president enormous discretion in dealing with these things. And indeed, a lot of the initial litigation had to do with people who had arrived in the United States with a legal right to be here and were physically in the United States. So that's kind of does not apply to the vast number of people that the executive order applies to. I just saw a news poll from CBS News saying that people there's a kind of a narrow majority of support for this, 51% support, 45% don't support. So the country's somewhat divided with a few more supporting it. But, you know, I think the idea of a temporary moratorium on entry to the United States from people in terror-plagued countries and a pause in refugees until, as Trump said in the campaign, we can figure out what's going on. I just think people are getting way too spun up over this. I think it's an entirely reasonable policy. It's what he campaigned on, and it's legal and it's constitutional.
But does it make – I mean, okay, maybe it is, but does it make sense if the numbers are small, if refugees are not the ones committing acts of terror – if we've had none out of these seven countries, you can make a sort of logical case for it. But you know, sometimes logic can be misleading.
Well, I think if you listen to the Trump people, they will say, first of all, there have been quite a number of terror attacks in the United States in the last 15 years. But they're looking at what's happening in Europe right now, in which there have been attacks in which the attackers used the rather chaotic refugee system over there.
But we don't have a chaotic refugee system. We have nothing like Europe's circumstances there, as you well know, Byron.
Okay, you're right. We have nothing like Europe. Orlando was nothing like Europe.
No, no, no.
San Bernardino was nothing
like Europe. They have millions that came in right over land.
And I will say September 11th was nothing like Europe. I think it was a bit worse. So if you look, just in the same way that some Democrats will say, well, let's look at the healthcare system in Scandinavia, the Trump administration is looking at the security system in Europe and saying this is a problem we do not want here. That is a reasonable thing to do.
Jack, are you missing something to the reasonableness of this?
It doesn't seem reasonable to me. It was part of his campaign, and he is, I think, justifying himself, and indeed, to a large extent, justifying his presidency on those grounds. It's important to have a responsible leader. I campaigned on this. I'm going to do it. But, you know, this was litigated in the campaign. There were those, you know, 100 former security officials in Republican administrations who warned against this kind of thing. Hillary Clinton did argue that this would arm ISIS with propaganda. It would, as they say, you know, give credence to their narrative that it's us against them, that the new crusade, the, you know, clash of civilizations, banning Muslims. The nuances aren't going to be noticed out in the on the Arab street. The nuances are going to be us versus them. That's not helpful to the overall to the necessity of American security policy to try to somehow de-radicalize or at least contain the threat from what Mr. Trump now calls radical Islamic terrorism.
We'll go to Woody in Austin, Texas. Woody, thank you for calling. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi. What do you think, Woody?
What do I think? Well, I think if you look at a country, like let's say Germany, has been very welcoming to the immigration or the refugee movement.
Yes, it was.
And Islam in general. And I think if you went back maybe prior to that, if you went back 40 years, there probably wouldn't be an incidence or statistics that would show you problems with migrants from the Middle East. But currently, if you took that, you'd see there's been a lot of incidents of violence, killings, rapes, some allowing them in, and having a more welcoming attitude doesn't seem to have displaced that. The people who are out to take down the West, regardless of how we interact with them, are still going to want to do that, whether we're nice or not.
I mean, Woody, Germany did bring in a lot, a million, and has still been, you know, despite President Trump's depiction of it, is still a quite peaceful country. But what about the difference in scale? We bring in a few tens of thousands. Do we need to worry about the same thing? It's not the same as them just walking in across Europe, is it?
It's not exactly the same, but what is wrong with having a temporary ban from high-risk countries until you can sort it out? Why not err on the side of caution?
Woody, I appreciate your call. Susan Page, what about it? Let's err on the side of caution here. What is it we're going to figure out? Or is this, I mean, some have said this is there are some in this administration who want that sort of clash of civilizations dynamic here, Susan.
Yeah, well, you know, I think Woody is really effectively articulating what President Trump's position is, which is it's a dangerous world. We want to control who comes into our country. We have a right to do that, and I'm going to do that. I think what distresses some Americans, though, is this sense of all immigrants are scary, Mexicans are murderers, no Muslim can be trusted, when we know that isn't true from our own neighborhoods and from people we know. And it's in some ways his harshest rhetoric is quite at odds with the American tradition of welcoming immigrants. And I think one other thing that has distressed some people is lumping refugees in with illegal immigrants. That's something he did in the discussion with Australia. You know, refugees are people who are fleeing a legitimate sense of danger, of oppression, who cannot stay where they are, and so they're kind of cast out and need a place to be. We vet the refugees who are allowed to come into this country have the most thorough vetting of anyone who crosses our borders. And that's one reason that we have had essentially no security problems with people who come here as refugees. Now, you can look at illegal immigrants, including the ones who come across our southern border, and say there have been cases of crimes committed, but it's different. So it's a kind of the lumping of everything in together and stirring it up in a big pot and making it seem quite terrifying to a lot of Americans that I think distresses some people who look at the president's rhetoric on this.
I wonder how the new
Can I say one thing about this Australian thing? Mm. I mean, it was kind of amazing that you'd have this fight between the American president and the Australian prime minister.
Old ally. Mm.
The countries are very, very close. Mm-hmm. On the other hand, if you go back and look at this deal that President Obama made with the Australian prime minister Turnbull in November after the election, there was a lot of talk at the time saying, not clear whether Donald Trump, we knew he was president at that point, whether Donald Trump is going to go with this.
And this is that the U.S. would take 1,000-plus refugees who Australia would not allow to step onto their mainland, who sort of housed on these little desolate islands.
Australia is very, very tough with refugees, and you're right.
Why did Obama agree to that, Byron? Do you know? What was the quid pro quo? What was the exchange here? Was it just a favor? I mean,
well, no, there was a deal in which I believe Australia had earlier accepted, and you need to correct me on this if I'm wrong, Central American refugees.
That's right. Yep.
And that so in turn, okay, Obama
there was a bargain. There was a deal.
Right. Now, and as far as the phone conversation is concerned, we don't know exactly. I will say that Donald Trump tweeted this morning, quote, "Thank you to Prime Minister of Australia for telling the truth about our very civil conversation that all caps fake news media lied about. Very nice!" Exclamation point.
I'm not sure that's what the Australian Prime Minister said.
Well, he did say for a fact that his version that Trump did not hang up on him.
Okay. Yes, right, great. That's kind of the minimal thing.
It's a ways from civil.
Well, it's more than was reported.
The president did not actually hang up on me. I'll tell you how bad the Australian call was. The Republican chairman of the Senate Foreign Relations Committee and the Republican chairman of the Senate Armed Services Committee felt it necessary after that phone call to call the Australian ambassador and say, "We're still friends."
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. In other news this week, violent protesters stormed around and onto the campus of the University of California at Berkeley on Wednesday over the scheduled appearance of Milo Yiannopoulos, a controversial right-wing journalist. His appearance was canceled. Got rough out there. Jon Stewart appeared on The Late Show with Stephen Colbert this week and read his version of an executive order from President Trump.
To secure our border, China shall immediately and without hesitation send us their wall. Done. Boom.
Okay. And the Boy Scouts of America announced this week that transgendered children who identify as boys will be able to join the Scouts. Christy Maldonado, whose transgendered son had been asked to leave his Cub Scouts troop in New Jersey, reacted to that news.
This was a wake-up call for him of how society could be so cruel. But then I'm happy because then no other child is going to have to go through what my child went through.
We are looking at a week in the news. Immigration ban and blowback, a Supreme Court pick. We'll talk about that. Trump battles Australia, new fighting in Ukraine. What do you think? What do you make of week two of the Trump administration? Are you surprised to see Steve Bannon in the inner circle of the National Security Council? And how does Justice Gorsuch sound to you? With Byron York of the Washington Examiner, Susan Page from USA Today, Jack Beatty's here, lots of callers on the line. Matt in New Orleans. Matt, thanks for calling. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for taking my call.
Yeah. What's on your mind?
So, over the last couple of days, we've been seeing a lot of, for lack of better words to call her, propaganda minister Kellyanne Conway and Spicer sort of creating artificial events just to sort of intensify what's going on.
What do you mean?
We've got Spicer saying that the Iranians attacked a military vessel, and that kind of got walked back a little bit, and they said, well, it's actually a splinter group in Iran. And then we've got Kellyanne with this Bowling Green massacre, sort of blaming two Iraqis for a terrorist attack on American soil in Bowling Green, Kentucky that never happened.
She was talking about a Bowling Green massacre, but this goes back to a couple of Iraqis who were arrested there back in 2011, sentenced to federal prison for attempting to send weapons and money to Al-Qaeda. But a Bowling Green massacre certainly didn't happen. What do you take from it, Matt?
I'm just afraid of it. I think the more that we sort of intensify this idea of an immigrant ban, that particular seven list of countries, it's been stated over and over again that no actual situations of danger on American soil have happened from people coming from those areas.
Yeah, that was a weird way of talking about it with Chris Matthews on MSNBC talking about the Bowling Green massacre, Kellyanne Conway. Let me hold that, Matt. We got a caller from Bowling Green, Kentucky. Chris, you're in Bowling Green. What do you think?
We're taking money for the massacre fund, Tom. Shannon Ragland on Facebook has already posted a website, and all sarcasm is intended with that comment. I'm sorry.
What?
Honestly, when that happened, the Iraqis were arrested. It barely made the news.
That was her point, but she was suggesting that there was some kind of covered up about what she called the Bowling Green massacre.
The black Suburbans killed a squirrel and a nest of cockroaches were destroyed. That's it. I'm a moderate Republican. I worked for Rand Paul, who is from Bowling Green, our U.S. senator, in his initial run. And I'm going crazy. This guy is doing stuff that's kind of cool. Going to Dover without you to see the SEAL, the return of the U.S.
The body of the U.S. Navy SEAL came back from the rough kind of botched raid in Yemen. Yep.
Yeah, and there was no hay made out of it. He just got in the chopper and left. And, yesterday I was listening to your show and I was screaming at some of the people because running to the right. And then I see this stuff on MSNBC, and I'm screaming and running to the left. I'm going crazy.
You mean because of the way Kellyanne Conway talked about what happened in your town, Bowling Green, you mean?
Yeah. There was this, when the Donald came into office, there was this big thing about fake news. Hey, she's become a big proprietor of fake news with this comment. Honestly, if you could see the post on Facebook and Twitter from all the victims of the Bowling Green massacre that didn't happen, it's laughable. It's sad.
Chris, I appreciate your call. Byron York, how about that kind of language and the way reality's being depicted?
Well, there wasn't a massacre, and I think Kellyanne Conway said this morning that she made a mistake. I mean, these were two. I believe this is this Bowling Green case is being used to point out potential problems with refugee screening, in the sense that there were a couple of refugees, Iraqi refugees, who were allowed into the United States, later found out that they had fingerprints on an IED in Iraq in their earlier lives, and that was pointed to as a major kind of a problem, a hole in the refugee vetting system. And I believe Rand Paul actually campaigned on it the first time and has talked about it, obviously not referring it to it as a massacre, but as
because
as
there was
a hole
no
in
massacre,
the,
right?
Of course.
Period.
Yes, there was no massacre. Yeah. We can all agree there was no massacre in mm-hmm. Bowling Green. Mm-hmm. But so I think that this is something, this is a case that some of the Trump people and just other Republicans like Rand Paul have pointed to as a potential problem
so
in refugee screening.
Yeah, yeah. I want to go to the Supreme Court, if we may. And of course, much anticipated there long after Justice Anson Scalia died early last year. And of course, Republicans refused to take up Merrick Garland, who was President Obama's nominee for the Supreme Court. President Trump came out this week and with some a little bit of razzmatazz at the White House, announcing his pick. Here he was introducing Judge Neil Gorsuch.
Not only are we looking at the writings of the nominee, and I studied them closely, but he is said to be among the finest and most brilliant, oftentimes the writings of any judge for a long, long time.
And then the judge himself, widely admired there in the White House, Neil Gorsuch.
When we judges don our robes, it doesn't make us any smarter, but it does serve as a reminder of what's expected of us. Impartiality and independence, collegiality and courage.
But what do the Democrats do? They felt very deeply burned by the zero action on Merrick Garland. Now they look at Judge Neil Gorsuch. Here was Senate Minority Leader Chuck Schumer in a speech on the Senate floor on Wednesday.
Judge Neil Gorsuch, throughout his career, has repeatedly sided with corporations over working people, demonstrated a hostility to women's rights, and most troubling, hewed to an ideological approach to jurisprudence that makes me skeptical that he can be a strong and independent justice on the court.
Susan Page, how do you see this unfolding?
The Democratic filibuster. Jeff Merkley, the senator from Oregon, has announced that he's going to lead one that's very much in tune with what the Democratic base, liberal base, wants their senators to do. But that does not mean he's not going to be confirmed, because Mitch McConnell, the Republican leader, has made it clear that he will get this justice nominee confirmed. And that means he is likely to deploy what we all call the nuclear option, which is to change the Senate rules so that you only need a majority. You don't need to get 60 votes to move ahead with the confirmation of a Supreme Court justice. You remember Harry Reid, when he was leading the Senate, when Democrats were in control, took the Senate almost all the way there for mm-hmm. presidential appointments other than the Supreme Court. And I think if Democrats launch a filibuster, as I expect them to do, I think that that final step is going to be taken to include Supreme Court justices. And that is going to change. That is, you know, I think
the nuclear option is going to be exercised, you're saying.
Yeah, that's right. And you know, Americans probably think, why do you call it the nuclear option? It doesn't sound like that big a deal. I tell you, in Washington and in the Senate in particular, this is going to be a big change in some of the assumptions that senators make about the rights of the minority in the Senate.
Do you think it's going to be – I'm going to ask Susan here. I'm not sure it's going to be a successful filibuster. I mean, Democrats tried to filibuster Samuel Alito and lost 19 of their own. I wouldn't suggest they'd lose that many now. But you do have these five Democratic senators up in 2018 in states that Trump won by double digits. So that's five. They need mm-hmm. eight. Mm-hmm. There is this thought among some Democrats that maybe this is not the hill to die on, and that they actually will not get there and actually force McConnell then to use a nuclear option.
It's true, and the number of Democrats – there are actually 10 Democrats up for reelection in 2018 from states Trump carried, five of them from states he carried in a walk. And so that may affect the politics of it. But I can tell you, I think you see the Democratic base and the huge demonstrations we saw on these first two weekends of this new administration stiffening the spine of Democrats on the Hill, because they risk being out of step with their own voters if they do not take a pretty hard line against this new president.
Jack, what do you see coming with Neil Gorsuch and of the nominee himself?
Well, he's an outstanding nominee. There's just no question about it. You know, the epithet stellar seems to be invented for him. And a conservative, But you know, elections have consequences, as John McCain said this week. This issue was on the ballot. Polling shows that Donald Trump made it salient. Overwhelmingly, people who voted on the Supreme Court, for whom that was primary, voted for Mr. Trump. Hillary Clinton did not do that. You know, she ran a campaign and basically said, Donald Trump is a lout. Well, there's a lot of evidence for that. But that wasn't enough. She didn't make this a salient issue. There weren't the million-person women marches against, you know, for Merrick Garland. And this is the result. And I think the Democrats are going to have to live with it, and perhaps worse down the line. But beyond that, there's this question of how do they respond to the Trump presidency. There's the base seems to want repeat what Mitch McConnell did, offer no alternatives, just no. Mm-hmm. But, you know, ideologically, that fit with conservatism. William F. Buckley said, conservatism says it stands athwart history yelling stop. Well, there it is. The Democrats are progressives. They believe in the politics of remedy. They can't just sit back and cynically say we're not going to offer any alternative. We're just going to say no, because, first of all, it would dispirit the young people who are, you know, really the future of the Democratic Party, who want some hope. And it would be false to their own essentially informing, inspiriting vision.
It's going to be something to watch, trying to deal with that base and this nomination at the same time. Donald Trump at the National Prayer Breakfast yesterday, kind of an unusual appearance there. Certainly not all buttoned up in religious terms, kind of secular at times. He was there talking about ratings for The Apprentice and how they went down after NBC producer Mark Burnett, who was also there, hired former California Governor Arnold Schwarzenegger to be the TV show's new host.
They hired a big, big movie star, Arnold Schwarzenegger, to take my place. And we know how that turned out. The ratings went right down the tubes. It's been a total disaster. And Mark will never, ever bet against Trump again. And I want to just pray for Arnold, if we can, for those ratings.
Byron York, what did you make of that? I mean, at a national prayer breakfast, this is a long way from piety.
What do you mean, what do I think? It was Trump. I mean, it was just totally Trump. I will say one thing. I've seen some people describe the prayer breakfast as this very solemn occasion, and that you know, Trump would never say something, or a speaker would never say something like this. There's been a lot of humor in speeches at the National Prayer Breakfast over the years. On the other hand, this was just so classically Trump that, you just got to look at it and laugh.
So Schwarzenegger responded like this. He put up a little video, posted to Twitter on Thursday morning.
Hey, Donald, I have a great idea. Why don't we switch jobs? You take over TV because you're such an expert in ratings, and I take over your job, and then people can finally sleep comfortably again.
Susan Page is like WrestleMania out there.
You know, the USA Today this week launched a Trump voters panel, which is 25 Trump voters from our last poll that we're going to keep in touch with through the year to see how they think Trump is doing. These are the people who put him in office. 25 of the 25 like the job he's doing as president. But when we ask them what concerned them, they said his tendency to pick a fight with everybody, to respond to every insult, and to go on Twitter. And that's what his own voters say he should tone down.
He did talk at the breakfast about repealing the Johnson Amendment. This is the one that forbids tax-exempt institutions, churches, and more from getting into the middle of political brawls. Here was the president at the National Prayer Breakfast.
I will get rid of and totally destroy the Johnson Amendment and allow our representatives of faith to speak freely and without fear of retribution. I will do that. Remember.
Ann in New Orleans. Thanks for calling, Ann. You're on the air.
Hello. Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Yeah. What are you thinking about?
So I'm originally from a country where Catholicism is the main, like, the government, like, the state law, the state religion, I'm sorry. And so I grew up with an archbishop who was frequently meddling into politics. So moving to this country, it was, like, refreshing to be in a country where there's a separation. When I go to church, I don't want to hear about politics. It's something that it should be left to the person. So I think now if he actually goes on and does this, and I don't know how plausible it is, and maybe one of your commentators can comment on how plausible it is, but I think it would muddy the waters. I think you would have then what the country stands on and the separation of church and state, you'd start having some confusion there on religious organizations or even priests and people talking from the pulpit endorsing candidates.
Yeah, and our time is so short, but I'm really glad for your call. Byron, what about it? Does it look practical to you that it could in fact be repealed, the Johnson Amendment?
Well, I don't think it's going to happen, and I don't think it's a good idea. I mean, I think that there's we've had some efforts in the past to try to kind of break down this this barrier, and I just don't think it's a good idea. Look, we have enough religious organizations and overall charity organizations that are somewhat politicized under the current system. I don't think we should make that worse.
Jack, why do you think the president's out there promising to destroy it in the prayer breakfast?
Well, he was very successful in the Republican primary in appealing to the religious right. He essentially went beyond their leaders and appealed to the rank and file, and this was part of it. I mean, right along, I heard them talking about this in South Carolina. I'd never heard of it. So this is another example of his, you know, he remembers he's going to dance with the people that brought him.
We're going to be passing the hat in churches in the next presidential campaign season, Susan, for campaigns?
Yeah, wait for it. Actually, I think it could pass the House. I don't think it could pass the Senate.
All right. There's early word on the Johnson Amendment. Susan Page with USA Today, Washington Bureau Chief. Great to have you with us this week. Thank you so much for joining us, Susan.
Thank you.
Byron York at the Washington Examiner. Great to have you, Byron. Thanks for being here.
Thank you, Tom.
And Jack, have a great weekend. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.